This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Pretty well. How's it going, Nate?
I'm good. You know, I've had a song stuck in my head all week. Those tricky genes that just can't see you, good man.
It's a catchy little ditty.
Warren did such a great job. I'm serious. Yeah. I've had it stuck in my head, and I've had a few listeners who emailed me as well. They've had it stuck in their head all week too, so it's been a lot of fun.
Well, I mean, Michael Jackson gets a little bit of credit for the melody.
Who?
It's catchy. It's not catchy. I mean, Warren's very talented.
I almost forgot.
I actually don't even know if Michael Jackson wrote the song. He probably didn't.
I think he
but,
did.
You know,
who
still,
knows?
He popularized
his team.
It, so.
Well, whatever the display was, I'm sure he got appropriately calibrated after that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Very much.
That's a segue for our first question.
Oh, cool.
How convenient.
Well, we've got a few questions today. The first one is what's called post-corona calibration process. And then after that, we've got a couple of questions that they sound different, but they actually have similar themes. So our first question, dear doctors, I'm interested in the post-coronavirus calibration process that many of us are likely going through or about to go through. I would bet that many of us are not feeling very calibrated to the sexual marketplace right now, whether we are single or not. Single people even more so, of course. I'd be interested to hear how this unique level of isolation we've all experienced leads to decalibration and then the process of recalibrating again. I'm just now starting to get back out there, and I get the sense that my nervous system is desperate for calibration while at the same time guarded against any potential bad news. This may be controversial, but I partly feel like some people may be wearing masks to avoid calibration. I live in a location with less than 10 cases across a population of a couple million, and a geographic area the size of Europe, yet people are still wearing masks. I know there are logical reasons to do so, of course, but it just occurred to me today that perhaps people could be wearing masks to avoid this post-corona calibration. Getting back to normal means getting calibrated again, and covering your face is a way of avoiding this. What do you think, doctors?
Well, I think Jen will have plenty to say.
It sounds like a chick question.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is actually that point has occurred to me in part because I have personally had the experience of needing to go run an errand and, you know, stopping to be like, oh yeah, you know, I should put some lipstick on and brush my hair, and then being like, I'm wearing the mask. It doesn't really matter. I'm not going to see anybody. They're not going to recognize me. Why go to the trouble? So I think there is definitely the point of people wearing masks to avoid calibration. I think that's probably a bit overstated. There's some of it in the sense that, you know, people are just under energy conservation and they're making the same kind of trade-off that I am, where it's like, oh, well, you're running to the grocery store and no one can see your face anyway. and people are not expecting to have their normal level of in-person flirtation when they're out and about. So all of that is true. But I think it's probably a pretty small part of the general cost-benefit analysis of why people are deciding to wear masks or not. I think they're wearing them for lots of other reasons, some of which are evidence-based and reasonable, and some of which maybe are less so. Just because you're in a rural area, I wouldn't expect that to be terribly different. So that's a piece of what people are doing, but probably a pretty small one. I think also the other thing that strikes me about this question is that unless something really meaningfully has changed in your physical appearance since March, there's not really a big process of recalibration going on. So, you know, what this person is asking about is sort of what is your market value on the dating market. And we've talked about this a few different times in a few different ways. And so that should not have meaningfully changed unless something has meaningfully changed about your appearance or about your mate value in some other way. So, you know, if you're no longer employed or your living situation has changed or your general station in life has undergone some sort of major transformation, which is true for a lot of people in the past couple of months. But the basics of sort of how attractive you would be to a potential mate are probably not that dramatically different than they were a couple of months ago. And they're not that dramatically different from most of the other people who are going to be out there looking for dates. And online dating has been going on this whole time. Like we talked about last week, most of the apps now have video dating. People are video chatting and FaceTiming and meeting for socially distanced drinks or not so socially distanced drinks. I think there's a wide degree of following the rules when it comes to this. So I don't think it's that big of an issue and that big of a deal. I think life sort of goes on in the same way that it was before all of the isolation. That would be my initial take on it. But I don't know if Doug has other things to add to that.
No, I don't think so. That's all makes perfect sense to me. You know, there's all the same reasons are there that we already know are there. No, I think that's it.
Yeah.
Check it. Call it good.
Sorry, there's not something more interesting going on. It would be sociologically fascinating if there was, if I had the sense that there was a big, you know, I mean, we talk a lot about competitive avoidance and the ways that people will latch on to any excuse to avoid fair competition. And that's very true. And I do think that that is in the CB of certain individuals, but I don't think it's terribly widespread.
And my self-calibration or my calibration, you know, got kind of set in there at about age 13 and it hasn't moved.
At 13, is that good or bad?
It was actually, I found out that I wasn't quite as fancy as I had thought I was. And then it stuck right there.
Yeah, I think I think it's really a pretty stable thing, unless you've got really dramatic changes in your appearance or your life station, which can happen for all kinds of reasons. They're not necessarily going to happen thanks to a stay-at-home order. So, yeah.
Yeah, I actually read recently that I think 76% of Americans have gained up to 16 pounds over the last...
16 is the average.
On average,
The data that I was looking at was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if I've only gained 2 pounds, someone out there gained 30.
Right.
Yeah. This sounds like National Enquirer data. You know,
I never take survey data seriously. Every survey class I ever took in grad school, I came out of there just shaking my head at how unreliable even the most sophisticated survey instruments can be. So it's really, survey data is really, really, really to be taken with a huge grain of salt. So yeah, if that was some USA Today poll.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was actually by Nutrisystem.
Probably not.
Oh yeah.
Oh, well, worse. There you go. But I have selection bias just because I've been talking to a lot of clients who have obviously had that experience. And so I think it's not unheard of that people have gained weight, but you know, the mask is not going to help you with that. So that's,
Yeah, yep. When I read this question, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, and I know Dr. Hawk, here comes the incoming toxic masculinity alarm, but when I read this question, God. I was reminded about something that Dr. Lyle said a long time ago on the podcast in the beginning when we were talking about face coverings in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And right. That there may be some women may not have such a problem with it because it evens the competitive field. As far as the beauty is concerned.
Sure. That's a nice cold blooded. Just go ahead and lay it at my door, Nathan. Right in front of Jen, no less.
I mean, lowers there. I don't even know where to start. I mean, these women in the Middle East are exercising a little less freedom of mate choice in general. Yeah. So they're facing a different set of competitive. I'm going to sit back and smile and nod.
Yeah. The evidence that I remember, and I can't remember who reported it. I have a feeling it was David Buss somewhere. And that is that I believe what I read was that the older the women got, the more the happier they were about having covering their faces.
But was that time series or was that just polling older, more conservative women?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I wouldn't know. You know, I can't defend against this. Jen Hawk, social science acumen.
survey data in the Middle East, you know, sure. Autocracy, like all of that's pretty unreliable at best. So, but it doesn't, I mean, I will concede the point that if you have an interest in competitive avoidance and hiding your face, you may be more amenable to a political mandate to cover your face. That could be possible, but I'd want to see some real data.
Sure.
Hard. Well, I'm glad to see that your toxic masculinity alarm is still out of batteries, Dr. Hawk. So.
COVID is such an amazing opportunity for scientists across the academic spectrum, including social scientists, to do these kinds of studies, you know. So this is really an opportunity to generate some robust data looking at those kinds of questions, although, you know, you're not going to get funding to do any kind of long-term study on something like that in any major U.S. university right now. So,
yeah.
But this is the pandemic that will launch a million really interesting dissertations if people are willing to ask interesting questions.
It sounds like it's going to be a very interesting next 10 or 20 years. Well, speaking
all
of,
right, what else we have, Nathan?
Speaking of the next 20 years, this is the next two questions are the ones that are a little bit different, but have similar themes. And this is about parental influence. So, dear doctors, in last few shows ago, episode 227, you covered parental influence or lack thereof. I'm curious why it seems that so many of us are programmed to want to push our kids to achieve if the long-term influence falls flat. Could it be all the parents wanting their kids to achieve early success to increase the parents' status and therefore possibly increase professional, social, and mating opportunities? Could the thinking be that if your kid gets into the prestigious prep school, it might increase the likelihood of landing a good network opportunity or a fling with a well-to-do mate, or just in general to upgrade your social circle?
Yeah. I mean, I think... let's talk briefly. Obviously, it is actually really interesting that they're essentially saying, look, with all of the efforts at education, we don't change a person's location with respect to their peers. And that's true. However, if we were to think about it in a slightly different way and say, okay, what if you had no education? None. Zero. Didn't learn how to read or write. Then would you be compromised when you're 18 looking for a job? The answer would be, yeah, you probably would be. Okay. So the issue is whether or not the educations are functionally equivalent enough and that essentially, so that the that the outcomes in the educational process are distributed according to the gene quality of how well people can contribute in the marketplace. And therefore, trying to make the education, quote, of higher quality, the delta between, quote, a high quality education and an average education is really nothing. It washes out. But that doesn't mean the education itself is useless. Okay, so now behind that, we're going to look back through that same concept. Would, if you were a parent in the Stone Age, would it pay to educate your children? Or just say, well, it doesn't make any difference anyway. No, I think it does make a difference. So again, but each child is more or less getting a functionally equivalent education, close enough. Fathers or mothers teach kids how to tie knots, teach them about local peculiarities of the landscape, educate them a little bit about the personalities of people in the village and what to look out for. In other words, there's useful information that comes along with parental or, paraparental instruction. And so from there, you can understand why parents would be interested in educating their children. From there, it's not a big leap to start to realize that the same instinct that would be in parents to try to get them to educate a kid to become more effective could, under certain circumstances, blossom out further than just attempting to influence the kid's education, but actually go even further in attempting to impact their success in the village in competition with particularly same-sex, competitors. Let's think this through, and when we really get down to parents pushing children, let's see, we've got two different options that would take us to why it is that this would be an instinct that would be being activated. One of them, obviously, is just general parental education. That should be a general species-wide instinct that we should see. But when we start to look at the pushiness that's involved in some parents, in fact, many parents, not all, though, but in many parents, we see a pushiness. And and we see it at two places. They'll push the children, and they'll also push the social environment in order to either give the child a break or in some way try to enhance the kid's competitive standing with respect to their competitors. So let's try to figure out why. One reason would be to increase the child's either survival or reproductive success in the future. The other would be to increase your own personal survival or genetic or reproductive success. And so that's where the questioner asks this question, and you can see the possibility of both. So I had a couple of friends of mine, they're a couple, and they're well steeped in evolutionary theory. And the woman is quite attractive. And she noticed when she was in a grocery store that she looked down the grocery store, and there was a kind of a nice looking guy looking at her, and then had his daughter with him. And the daughter was, about 5 or 7 years old and pretty. And the guy actually pulled the daughter towards him and then had both of them look at my friend and smile and be friendly. And my friend walked out of there calculating, thinking, what was he trying to do there? And her inference, which I think was very intelligent and probably accurate, was, look how I make beautiful children. Okay, so in other words, your offspring are advertisements of your gene quality. Of course they are. So therefore, it would make sense that parents would be using their children as advertisements for themselves, for mates.
The same reason that guys will walk a cute dog in the park. It's the same process.
Yeah. God, I hadn't thought about that.
Advertising personality and parenting skills. Sure. And gene quality and all those things.
Yeah. Oh, man. Now you tell me. Now you tell me, Jen.
Yeah, get a dog, Doug.
Oh, man. Wait, aren't dogs like
that? It's your cat. Oh my God.
I don't even know the punchline to that joke. I'm just gonna. I don't know. But the point is that's
a reference that you made. Oh. You said dogs having a dog on if you're dating is kind of like having herpes.
I don't know. Oh, well, that's a fortunate.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Yeah, that's right.
Out, but it's
now
it's too good.
No. All right. Well, back to my story before I get totally lost. So you can see that your children are going to be advertisements for your genes. And it would have been the case that in the Stone Age, we wouldn't have been in super long-term pair-bonded situations where we're just going to be monogamously pair-bonded to one guy and we're going to have five children by him. No way. That's not human nature. So human nature is full of stepfatherhood, new mates. You know, it's musical chairs. And that's how the species is built, obviously. All we have to do is looking at the dating careers of people as they become increasingly free in the modern world from the shackles of poverty that lead to very, very low divorce rates. And now we have people that are, you know, in free societies, you know, when they are able, they move on. And so this is clearly the pattern that the species is built on. It's not built with intensive pair bonding of an emperor penguin. And so, then children would be advertisement for mates. So yes, that's one reason that parents will push children. The another reason that they will push children is what I call why mom cares. And that is that you can imagine in the Stone Age that you would only have a few mates, mating opportunities. There was only 2,000 people on Earth about 75,000 years ago. So they're scattered throughout sub-Saharan Africa. So this is, you can imagine, like, you know, that's less than we're in my high school. So that's not a lot of people. And as a result, obviously there's been a lot more people since then. It's been a very successful species. But very often in hunter-gatherer terms, which is where almost all the neural circuits were built, even though they've been shaped by agriculture and high population densities since then. But the original equipment is certainly built to be dealing with situations where there are a very low number of mating opportunities. And suppose your son, for example, is a 6 or a 7, and there's a 10 in the village and a 9 in the village, and there's a 3 in the village. And there's 4 or 5 girls that are about the same age group cohort as those 4 or 5 boys. And we know the most attractive girl and the most attractive boy are likely to get together. And the second most attractives are likely to get together. And the least attractives are likely to get together. So our action might be between your son, who's a 6, and the other son, who's a 7. Or maybe your son is the 7 and the other woman's son is a 6. And on the other side of the equation, there's an 8 female and then there's a 5 female. So there could be a 30 percentile reduction in attractiveness of the mates, depending upon whether or not you win the 8 or you wind up with the 5. And so that kind of discrepancy between two alternative mates would have been common in the Stone Age environment. That's not taking place today. So taking place today, there's no way. If you're someone who could claim an 8, then you're going to wind up in that general range. You're not one hair's breadth away from being an 8 versus a 5. That's not the way it is now. But that is the way it probably was for much of human history. And as a result, it wouldn't be surprising to find conniving mothers that are essentially trying to figure out how to make their kid look better than the other kids, particularly this specific competitor. And, you know, this is what goes on in the soccer stand as mothers talk about how their kid, you know, plays the game right and how the team does so much better when he's in the game, even though he's, you know, 7th kid on the bench. But she's still trying to sell her kid's virtues to the village. And that's, you know, it could be that she's trying to sell her own genes, but it could also be that she's trying to sell his genes, which are her genes, in attempting to protect against the disastrous theoretical possible drop of 30 points a percentile in a mate. Those 30 percentile points would cause any offspring out of there to be 15 percentile less attractive. that's a huge deal. It can be the difference between success and failure in the gene pool period. So anyway, I think that those are two different, you know, two completely different reasons why it is that parents would push children. And I think that neither of those has any breaking force put on it by the Plowman-esque discoveries that we can't change personalities and we can't change IQ, and we're unlikely to have a significant alteration in a major educational effort in someone's, you know, socioeconomic trajectory. No, that's because people aren't being massively handicapped or massively, what would you call that? They aren't also being, what do you call it, Jim?
Advantaged.
Advantaged. Yes, thank you. The privileged word of the day.
Wasn't going to say that. That's a very specific meaning.
I can't even get the word out. She's already considering three or four alternatives. The the quote privilege is not going to be particularly helpful as we're seeing. So what would be the instincts that would be driving the pushing that you see? I think personal advertisement for you directly, and also the anxiety that comes with knowing that the other mom is pushing her six or seven, trying to get her kid one nose in front of your kid in search of that eight. And so if it's game theory, if they all got some pushiness involved, some braggartry chip about the genes of their kid, then you would expect that if they brag, I'm going to brag. And that process then would evolve in the species, which I absolutely think that that's exactly what we see. We see a bragging chip and a pushing
particularly.
Chip. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, again, has been leveraged massively by social media. Mm-hmm. If you're a single mom of that kid mm-hmm. trying to show off your genes, and you've got an Instagram account where you can show the smiling photo and you're in competition with the other single moms with the kid at the soccer game. There's a whole incentive structure that's been created by social media that, defaults as a marketplace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if not an active marketplace, at least a calibration space and an advertising space and everything else. You're like the degree to which humans are always advertising their personality characteristics and their mate value has just been absolutely, exaggerated beyond belief by social media incentives. So
yeah. Fabulous.
All right.
All right, Nathan.
Fantastic.
All good.
Well, our next question, which sounds similar. Which sounds different, I'm sorry. Dear doctors, I'm struggling to realize the last chapter of the book, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, where the author describes freedom from wanting to control others. I have a 29-year-old brother who still lives with my mother. He was working before the pandemic, but is now currently unemployed. He has consistently made thousands of dollars a month, but pays her nothing. He says she doesn't care and he is wanted there. She says she doesn't mind. In the past, I have argued about why this relationship is bad for them both. I'm having a hard time with why this situation makes me so angry, when really it is none of my business. I would love to be free of my concern, but it feels deeply concerning that from what I see, my brother is exploiting my mother to avoid life, and she is enabling him because she doesn't want to live alone.
Yeah, that's a nice Jen, I'm gonna just talk about this and then you whatever it
it's,
is that I
yeah,
miss
I mean, it's the, yeah it's really the same problem upside down, so go ahead and elaborate, but I think we've basically kind of already covered the dynamic.
Yeah, the dynamic is that what Jen and I would try to argue with parents is the following: is that your children are highly incentivized to try to go out there and earn esteem that is going to be useful for them. And so they're pretty savvy about it. And as a result, you know, if they want to dye their hair purple and they're all determined that that's what they want to do, it's probably a good idea to let them do it. Okay? So if it reduces your mating success because your kid looks like a freak, too bad. Okay. The truth is that they know what they're up to. And so we let them experiment and do that. And so this is what Jen and I call running their own show. So your kid, you may say, oh no, that's a terrible way for you to win mates. I just know that you're going to fail. That's a bad strategy. Oh, well, how do you know? You're looking through their mating problem through your own eyes. You don't know who they're going for and who they're trying to advertise for. They may be advertising to the same sex and you don't even know what's going on with them. So the point is that this is why we let them run their own show. Now, they have to have reasonable expectations of group living so they don't get to dirty the dishes and not do clean their room. You know, they have to like answer to us so that they don't make our lives burdensome more than it should be. But our job is basically to let them figure their life out. And then when they get into trouble or they may be making catastrophic errors that they don't understand, then we're going to step in, of course. This is the upside down version of this. This is the same little chip in there. Of course, there could be many reasons that we could think through in this situation about why this bothers the questioner. I don't think this is the reason, but we could immediately say, well, now wait a second. Is this just a disturbance of seeing parental resources go to my brother rather than to me? Okay. And,
or
oh, no,
a
it
principle
isn't.
That
yes.
the groundwork has been laid
yes.
for that, even if those resources are not currently in contention. This is
right.
This is demonstrating that the resources are becoming less and less available to your potential claim on them in the future, should you want to make one. So
right.
And that, you know, resources both in terms of her actual assets mm-hmm. and also just her time and attention. I mean, those things are all valid, and they're going to interact with the personality of the person who is asking the question as well. But yeah, that's the first thing that comes to mind, is that there's a resource distribution conflict here.
Yes. It could also be the case in what the person is sort of reporting, and it very likely is the case, that what they're seeing is that they're seeing that their parent is sort of their child. And that they feel like the parent is a vulnerable first-degree relative that is being exploited by another first-degree relative, or it could be anybody, but in this case, it's a first-degree relative. And so as a result of that, it's raising the ire of our questioner. And because essentially what's happening is that it doesn't seem, quote, fair. Now, remember that analysis is being run through your eyes. It's not being run through the two individuals who are actually making the trade. So it's useful to know that your mother, just like your kid, is better at running the cost-benefit analysis and looking out for her best her own interest than you are. Okay? So just as you would let your kid dye their hair purple and shrug your shoulders and roll your eyes and chuckle about it, okay? In other words, if you've got some little rebellious kid that wants to show you, you know, that, you know, they listen to Bob Dylan records and they're looking for the resurgence of the 60s, you know what I mean? They want to show you that how out of it you are, then, you know, the worst thing that we can do is fight them about it. And the best thing we can do is say, go ahead, it's your own funeral. What do I care? Okay. And just basically drop the rope and don't pull on it. And in this case, you have there's been cross-examination and a history of this dynamic. And so the mother would appear to be a competent individual, still cognizant of everything. We're not talking about someone with some kind of compromised mental function. If the son's 29, then it's unlikely that mom is older than 69. And so this is absolutely comes under the category of let her run her own show. And the she is in a better position to run the CB and what is her best interest. And examine clearly, you know, your own motivation to see whether or not what's upsetting you is to feel like that your brother is winning the contest over mom's, you know, affections, that could be what's happening, or that could, what could also be happening is that there's actually real live resources that could be possibly on the table, but it's disturbing for you to see that dynamic being set up in a way that's not good for you. So this is, mm-hmm. you know, more than one possibility here, but in the end, we sort of crystal clear ourselves as to, you know, why am I angling for those resources? If that's an issue, and if it is the case that what's being signaled is a possibly greater affection for your brother than for you, so be it. Okay, there may be temporary or permanent reasons why that could be true, and if they are, they are. And that doesn't mean that your mother doesn't love you. It just may mean that she may love your brother a little bit more or consider him more needy right now, that she wants to invest those resources in order to assist him. So complicated CBs that are going through the mother's mind, and the printout is, I'm fine with it. And if she's fine with it, you know, we need to let it go.
The other two things that just come to mind really quickly are the other resource scuffle that is kind of at play here is the reference to how the brother was employed and now he's not, and he's using this relationship with their mother to, quote, avoid life. And so it's sort of like this observation that, hey, I'm out here doing things the right way. I'm mm-hmm. working for my money. I'm, you know, I'm putting in my time. I'm slogging through. Like, it's not fair that you're getting this free ride. And so that's going to drive that the anger that's coming from that perception of that kind of fairness. Like I, you know, I could take the easy road too, but mm-hmm. I have better character. And so I'm not doing that. But that CB that's being yeah. run by that brother, yeah. like both of their CBs, it's really interesting. I've had so many people ask me in the last couple of days, what on the podcast, when you say CB, what do you mean? So I just want to, it's cost benefit analysis. So yeah. I know that I always try to spell it out at least once, but just in case people are confused, we're talking about the cost benefit analysis, where people are, you're always making trade-offs, you're always analyzing, is this worth my time and energy based on the perception of what I'm going to get in trade for the effort that I'm putting into it. So those, both of these humans have enough experience where they have run the CB and they have likely come to conclusions in the brother's case that you know, maybe he is not looking at that much competitive success out there in the working world, and this sort of little bit of this ego trap, this kind of like, you know, go live at home with mom, not only is it just strategically better, you know, he's not necessarily doing it for evil reasons or like directly avoidant reasons. He may be doing it because he's perceiving that he can't otherwise be very successful in a fair marketplace. So that's part of what might be going on. And then for the mother's part, she's also had many opportunities to run the CB on how else she can have companionship. And she may not be very well calibrated on the mating market. She may not be looking for romantic companionship. She may not have very many good friends. And this is really the sum total of her social experience. And she has had enough of an opportunity to evaluate that and really think about it. And this comes out as favorable for her as well. So they have a little dynamic that is irritating that you are outside looking in on, but it is an equilibrium that is mutually beneficial to both of them, as Doug is saying. And you are just, there's this feeling that it's not fair and you've been left out and you have to do it the hard way. And that sucks, but that's where
wonderful.
It is.
Wonderful. Wow. Thank you, Dr. Hawk, for
all
that.
Good.
Beautiful. Information. Yeah. And Dr. Lyle as well. All right. So our next question. Dear doctors, when women write, quote, family-oriented, end quote, on a dating profile, is this code for, quote, looking for man who will invest all his resources into me and our potential children? And also, quote, I'm vetting your current relationship with your mother as proof?
My goodness. Mm. Someone cynical. I mean, it's... I'll just go ahead and jump in. Sure. Sounds like another chick question. So I would say when women write that they're family oriented on a dating profile, yes, they are definitely signaling very strongly that they're looking for a pair bonder and not for casual mating. So one way to interpret that is that they're looking for a man who will invest all of his resources into me and our potential children, although that's a little bit of a cynical way to look at it. Vetting your current relationship with your mother is proof, maybe in certain circumstances, but not necessarily. I mean, family oriented in the sense that, yeah, they're going to want to know that you have a good relationship with your family in general, or if you don't, I mean, I think this is going to come down to, there's going to be a lot of different individual variations on what different women mean by that phrase. Some are going to use it to mean you really want to have children, and some are going to use it to mean you spend every weekend hanging out with your family. So I wouldn't take that too broadly when you encounter it. I would take it as an absolute signal that she's a pair bonder and she's not looking for a one night stand. And you know, I'm always encouraging women on their dating profiles to absolutely drop these kinds of signals to potential suitors, because it's there's this feeling that you want to be kind of coy and subtle on your dating profile about what you're looking for, because you don't want to rule out too many people. So you want to kind of, there are these key phrases that my friends and I always used to make fun of when we would look at profiles, which are, you know, that you're trying to signal both that you're up for fun and that you're very serious and family minded. So the, you know, equally at home and high heels and tennis shoes was a phrase that we would just see over and over and over again, or equally at home in a wine bar in a baseball stadium. You'd see that one in Boston all the time. And so this kind of, I'm up for anything. I'm here. I'm going to front that I'm available for casual mating, but really I'm lurking, looking for a pair bond. Don't do that. If you're really truly looking for a pair bond, you want to be really deliberate with those signals, and make it really clear to the guys that you're looking for that that's what you're in this game for. And a phrase like family oriented is one of those ways to do that.
God, that's great, Jen. I hadn't quite grabbed that. And that is a, I'd sort of gotten there before, but I hadn't quite nailed that. That's beautiful. This is a derivative of the little deal that I did last week or two on our website called How to Solve a Problem, and a key issue in problem solving, which is solving a problem, is finding a way to close the distance between where you are now and where you want to be. And that's a goal. And then there are problems that stop you. In other words, problems are obstacles on our way to goals. And one of the biggest difficulties that people will sometimes face is that they have multiple agendas. And so they have more than one goal, and those goals are actually not consonant. And so they have different behavioral pathways to get to them, and i.e. contradictory. And so the natural confusion that sits inside of the female mating strategies, you know, both trying to pass on their genes to a sexy son from some sexy floundering dude that's going to love them and leave them. That's in there. That's the titillated possible chip inside the female that is receptive to casual mating for exactly that reason. And at the same time, though, a bigger, more dominant component of female psychology is pair bond strategy. And so you can see, it's funny that the quote high heels and baseball game thing, that is precisely, she's splitting the difference. So she's literally signaling two different signals. And she herself is halfway confused, you know?
Yeah. Well, she thinks she can redeem the bad boy. She thinks she can redeem the bad boy with the high heels and then snag him and turn him into a stadium goer with the tofu dog and the kids. So, yeah, it's not going to happen. The guy that you snag with the casual mating signal is not going to magically turn into Prince Charming with the pair bond. These are two different candidates on the online dating profile matrix. And so you can advertise to one or the other, but you cannot advertise to both. Or if you advertise to both, you're going to be dealing dealing with a lot of brokenheartedness with the casual mating suitors who are self-deceptive and very interested in deceiving you. And you're going to feel all excited and weak-kneed and over-rewarded by them. And then you're going to be very bitter and cynical after a couple of years of being loved and left in a hurry and ghosted repeatedly before you can go to that baseball game.
Dr. Hawk speaks the truth. I've had this exact scenario on the phone in consults at least twice in the last 2 weeks. So I think we got the math right, Jen. it won't explain every twirl of every person's game, but it explains the mega trends that sit under these dilemmas, without a doubt. That's great. All right. I think that's about enough
good,
for one night.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk.
All right. Solved enough of the world's problems.
Very good work.
Yeah, all good.
Gotten ourselves into enough trouble.
Yeah, got it.
Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. We will look forward to asking and answering some more questions next week.
Fantastic.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Nathan.
All right. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe. Write us a review or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.